This is Take Care, a health and wellness show produced by WRVO Public Media. Thanks for joining us. I'm Catherine Loper.
And I'm Jason Smith.
For the latest in health, we start with a new algorithm that could improve the diagnosis of rare diseases.
Rare diseases can be marked by a genetic mutation, but when it comes to diagnosis, finding that gene and ruling out others could take clinicians hours, potentially an entire week of work. But a team of researchers at Stanford is trying to change that.
Gil Bejarano is an associate professor at the Stanford School of Medicine. Earlier this year, in a paper published in Genetics in Medicine, his team revealed an algorithm that could improve our ability to diagnose rare diseases.
Just imagine for a minute that you're a doctor. You have a patient and are suspicious that they may have a rare disease with an underlying genetic cause. If you were, in fact, a doctor, you might send their genetic code out for sequencing to find the problematic gene.
You send them out to sequencing. The sequencing comes back, you analyze it very carefully, and then you're faced with, let's say, 200 genes, any one of which could have caused a person's disease. And then what currently happens is there are medical professionals, clinicians, who sit down and essentially go gene by gene over these 200 in the hope of finding the one gene that can explain the patient's disease.
The process, as our guest describes it, is arduous and expensive.
So our basic observation behind this work is saying, look, you know, clinician time is expensive. Computer time is cheap. Why don't we get the computer to do absolutely as much as it can before the clinician comes on the scene?
One key thing to note here is that they're not interested in replacing the clinician, but setting them up on better footing to make decisions that only a human can. Does this person have this particular rare disease, and is this the gene mutation that caused it?
So the idea is that when the clinician shows up on the scene, they go down the list the way the computer organized the list for them, and hopefully immediately at the first gene, they just look at it and say, yep, the algorithm was right, this is the diagnosis. And if they don't, they go down to the second gene, etc. So the whole premise there is make clinicians work more efficient by doing as much as possible with the computer before the clinician starts to look at the case.
The algorithm is combing through a lot of information to make these lists. The patient's genes and phenotypes, essentially the signs and symptoms the patient is experiencing, and finally, a body of peer-reviewed papers.
You conceptually go to a body of all peer-reviewed papers that were ever published, and there are about 26 million of those, and you try to assemble a database of all genes and which phenotypes they may be causing through different diseases.
Their database includes information about which genes cause which diseases and what the symptoms are. That's the information the algorithm combs through, trying to compare them to what the patient's actual concerns are and to their genetic code.
The algorithm is called FRANK, by the way, with a PH for phenotype combined with the word rank. Bejarano says it is a work in progress, as are many algorithms.
We want to see as many patients as possible that have already been diagnosed. So this is something where, you know, we have this interesting conversation with the healthcare system because they naively would say, dude, really diagnose them. What do you care? And we say, no. It's the cases you diagnose that I need to train my system. You know, I want my system to put the causal gene that you found at the top.
The 5,000 rare diseases in Frank's database are all caused by mutations to a single gene and have no environmental component. If you have that mutation in your genome, you'll get the disease, but Bejarano sees the possibility for expansion from there.
We're going to start in rare diseases, build this wonderful semi-automated systems that help the clinician deal with a flood of data, and then expand from rare diseases into the more common ones as our understanding of the common diseases improves. Because right now, common diseases are somewhat mysterious in their underlying genomics. There is so many combinations of different genes that seem to be slightly messed up, but only in a tiny way, and somehow together they cause a lot of our more common diseases, that I think we need to improve our genomic understanding of common diseases before an approach like FRANK could be fully used there. But we and the community at large are making headways in those respects as well. So it's a wonderful beachhead into tackling all of medicine that has an underlying genetic component.
You can find out more about FRANK, the algorithm, and research out of Bejarano's lab online at med.stanford.edu. The study we discussed is found in Genetics in Medicine.
Sticking with technology, our next conversation is with Catherine Schwab, an associate editor at Fast Company, who covers technology, design, and culture. We spoke with her because of her recent experience at what some are calling the health lab of the future. Thanks for being with us, Catherine.
Thanks so much for having me.
You visited Mount Sinai's Lab 100. That's an experimental clinic that's a collaboration between Mount Sinai and a design studio known for mixing digital tech with physical architecture. Can you tell us a little bit about the lab?
Sure. So Lab 100 is a really interesting space. It's kind of hidden in the corner of Mount Sinai's medical school library. And you walk in and it feels like you're in the future. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. It's so far away from a regular doctor's visit. And the goal with the lab is to help healthy people understand what the baseline of their health is. And so the lab's goal is to try and connect lifestyle choices that people are making when it comes to diet, exercise, etc., to actual health metrics that can be tracked over time.
So this lab focuses on healthy people rather than the traditional model of you go to the doctor when you're sick. Can you talk a little bit more about some of the differences that you saw in this lab as opposed to, say, going to a traditional doctor's office?
Yeah, they do a ton of different tests that are much more extensive than anything you'd get at the doctor's office. Probably the most interesting, there was a balance test, which I have never done before. They had me stand on a foam pad with my eyes closed and my arms crossed over my chest.
When you're going through these tests, did they tell you the purpose of these tests? I mean, obviously these are things that you don't experience at a normal doctor's office. So what would a balance test, how would that explain your overall health?
They did explain everything as I was going through, and I was also asking a ton of questions. I think the balance test is the best example of this because Dr. David Stark, who started the lab and runs the lab, he took me through everything. And he said, you know, we don't test for this and we only find out when you have a fall for the first time. And that, you know, that fall, he said, could land you in the hospital with a hip fracture. So if you know that your balance isn't great and once you have that information, you can actively work on it.
So if one of the goals of this lab and these tests is to sort of break down your health information and maybe try to push you to make certain adjustments, like with your balance, in your experience, did you find that this kind of changed your ideas about health?
Yeah, you know, I really enjoyed my experience there. I don't think I would have ever gone of my own accord because we're so not used to thinking about health in this way. I'm healthy, I'm young, I exercise, why do I need to go to the doctor? But seeing everything kind of laid out in front of me helped me kind of make some connections that I probably wouldn't have made otherwise. I actually think for me, the biggest change came from one of the surveys that I did before arriving at Lab 100. So that's how they help assess your diet, exercise, those kinds of things. So those are still self-reported. But one of the hardest things for me to input into one of the surveys was how much I sit every day. And when I really thought about that question, how much do I sit every day? And I think my answer was something like 8 to 10 hours at least. Physically inputting that into the computer system was very difficult for me. And that piece of information, just that feeling that I got that, oh, you know what, I don't want to be this sedentary, that has helped me use a standing desk at work.
You wrote in your article that you had to give consent from Mount Sinai to use your anonymous lab results in other studies. Do you know
Yes.
what makes it into their data bank of sorts?
The data that they collect during Lab 100 basically all goes into a database in a de-identified manner, from my understanding. And you can either consent to have them use that data in other studies or not. Ideally, for them, these are long-term studies where if they have enough people who go through Lab 100 and then they have people come back periodically, they can kind of track how people's lifestyle changes impact their health over time. So that's one of the main goals of the lab is to you know, understand those trends more long-term. Though that's going to take, obviously, a lot of time. I mean, this opened just in the last year, so they've got a long way to go before they get to that point, but that is one of the goals.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a great conversation.